The headlines: Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi tells his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin cooperation among countries targeted by U.S. sanctions will make them strong. China's President Xi Jinping says his country is willing to work with Russia to support each other's core interests. Plus, millions of Muslims are on a pilgrimage to the holy shrine of Imam Hussein in the Iraqi city of Karbala. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran's president says cooperation among countries targeted by U.S. sanctions will make them stronger.
The relationship between countries that are sanctioned by the U.S., such as Iran, Russia, or other countries, can overcome many problems and issues and make them stronger.
The Iranian president said Americans think by imposing sanctions against the country, they can stop it, but they are wrong. Referring to the JCPOA revival talks, Raisi censured the Western states for proposing to hold negotiations while at the same time imposing new sanctions. He said they need to demonstrate goodwill for the revival of the 2015 deal. Raisi is in Uzbekistan to attend the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit. He made the remarks in a meeting with his Russian counterpart. He said Iran and Russia can offset the effects of U.S. sanctions by joining their forces. The two presidents underscored a joint resolve to enhance strategic ties. And President Putin of Russia said relations with Iran are positively developing.
Relations between Russia and Iran are developing on all the vectors that have been formed in previous years. We are in the final stage of working on a new major treaty between Russia and Iran, which will mark the developing of relations at the level of a strategic partnership.
Putin said a delegation from Russia with representatives of 80 large companies will visit Iran next week. The Russian president welcomed Iran, becoming a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. On Wednesday, Iran signed an SCO Memorandum of Commitments and Arrangements, getting one step closer to becoming the ninth member of the regional body. Iran's accession is expected to be finalized by April 2023. We talked to political analyst Fouad Izadi about the significance of Iran joining the SCO. Let's take a listen.
I think it's both is in interest of Iran to be a member of SCO, and also it's good for SCO to have Iran as a member. Iran is an important Asian country. Iran is number one in terms of oil and gas. It's very much energy rich, and Iran, with in cooperation with Russia, could basically provide the energy needs of the Asian continent. Given the historic role of Iran, given the civilizational background of Iran, and given the fact that many of the countries that are member of the SCO are culturally, religiously related to Iran. Iran being part of the SCO is going to be important. And also given the fact that Iran is under sanctions, cooperating both economically and trade and other linkages, economic linkages that Iran will have with SCO countries would be beneficial for Iran to go around sanctions. And we know Russia is under sanctions. China increasingly is facing sanctions from the United States. So this is what I was referring to earlier, that you're seeing the earliest stages of a new world order where Asian countries are going to cooperate more and have the United States leave this part of the world. They can stay in the North American continent. It's large enough for them. They don't need to be poking other countries, especially in Asia.
We have also reached out to a Eurasia and a Caucasus affairs expert, Ahmad Qasimzadeh, to discuss the importance of Iran's membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. He believes the SCO can be considered the NATO of the East.
Regarding the significance of Iran's membership in the SCO, it should be noted that the organization includes several countries such as China, India, with a high population, almost half world population, with major economic benefits for member states. I can also refer to security matters.
Meanwhile, China and Russia have held talks on the sidelines of the Shanghai Cooperation Summit. President Xi Jinping has told his Russian counterpart that Beijing is willing to work with Moscow as major powers in the face of global changes.
Facing an ever-changing world, era, and history, China is willing to make efforts with Russia to assume the role of great powers and play a guiding role to inject stability and positive energy into a world rocked by social turmoil.
Vladimir Putin, for his part, commended China's, quote, balanced position on the conflict in Ukraine. He said that the Russian president also sided with China over the issue of Taiwan. He censured the U.S. for provocations over the island. Putin also said attempts by Washington to create a unipolar world will fail. That was the first in-person talks between the two presidents since Russia launched its military operation in Ukraine last February. Meanwhile, Russia says the United States would, quote, cross a red line if it decides to supply Ukraine with a long-range missile system known as HIMARS. Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova has warned Washington if it does so, it would become a party to the conflict. She said Moscow reserves the right to defend its territory. The U.S. has supplied Ukraine with advanced rockets. Washington says Kiev has promised not to use them to strike Russian territory. In the meantime, the United States is preparing to send Ukraine another package of security assistance. Ukraine has requested and received large quantities of weaponry from the United States and its Western allies in the face of the Russian military operation. Moscow says the operation is aimed at preventing Ukraine from being used as a platform for Western aggression. And Tehran has censured Washington's new sanctions against a number of Iranian individuals and entities over the alleged cyber threats. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said making false propaganda and spreading disinformation about the Islamic Republic is part of Washington's failed policy of Iranophobia, and it will get nowhere. He said such, quote, sordid, illegal, and twisted behavior towards independent nations shows the U.S. politicians' inability to understand global equations or adapt themselves to the realities of the world. The official said that Iran itself has been a target of cyber attacks. He said the Islamic Republic has therefore been an important part of the international efforts against such activities. Kanani said Washington has always turned a blind eye to cyber attacks against Iran's infrastructure and even its peaceful nuclear facilities. He said the U.S. has even directly and indirectly supported such attacks. On Wednesday, the U.S. imposed sanctions on then-Iranian individuals and two entities, accusing them of, quote, malicious cyber activities. Israel presses ahead with its crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied territories. We discuss this in our news review program. Welcome to this edition of the News Review. In this edition, Palestinians hold a funeral for a teen who fell victim to Israeli gunfire near the city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry identified the victim as Uday Salah, saying that he was killed by a bullet to his head. He lost his life when the Israeli military stormed his neighborhood in western Jenin overnight. The raid comes a day after the two Palestinians lost their lives during an ambush against an Israeli military checkpoint near the same city, which also left an Israeli soldier dead. Israel uses routine night raids across the West Bank, Jenin in particular, as a tactic to scare Palestinian residents. Dozens have been killed during these attacks this year. Facing decades of poverty and violence, Jenin has become a focal point of resistance against the Israeli occupation. We're joined by our correspondent Mona Kendall from Ramallah, and also with us we have Saad Nimr, professor of political science from Brightside University, also from Ramallah. Let's begin with Mona to get an update on the situation there. Mona, tell us more about these Israeli atrocities. We're hearing every day something new about them.
That's right. Every day, Israeli forces raid Palestinian cities, villages, and refugee camps in the occupied West Bank. And we have to say that these raids had been taken place mainly in the Jenin area. As what happened this morning, Israeli troops raided the town of Kfar Dan, western Jenin, in order to surround or interrogate family members of the Palestinians who were killed yesterday at the Jalama refugee, at the Jalama military checkpoint. Of course, the Israeli forces interrogated family members of the two Palestinian martyrs, and they even arrested at least one relative of those martyrs. Clashes took place between the Israeli forces and Palestinian youths. This led to the death of Palestinian teenager, Palestinian teenager Uday Salah. He was shot in the head, as you have mentioned, and then he succumbed to his injuries. Three other Palestinians were wounded, and at least eight Palestinians were detained from Kfar Dan town. In addition to more than a dozen Palestinians had been detained across the occupied West Bank. Every day we are speaking about raids. Every day we are speaking about detentions among the Palestinians. And recently we had been speaking about at least every day or day after day a Palestinian forces do not want for the Palestinians to be any form of struggle against the Israelis. And that's why they keep raiding the Palestinian areas, detaining people, killing Palestinians in cold blood, knowing at the end of the day that they would not be interrogated or dragged to any trials.
Professor Nimr, if you could please tell us what your take is on the increased Israeli atrocities, what we're hearing from our correspondent in Ramallah right now. You just heard her describe how getting more and more reports about the Israeli regime and Palestinians, killing them in cold blood, without any reasons even.
Yes, it's quite clear that the Israeli atrocities, which has been escalated by the beginning of this year in numbers and in the kind of atrocities against the Palestinians everywhere, in addition to supporting the settlers who are also attacking the Palestinians and grabbing the land, and all these atrocities against the Palestinian, definitely will retract again the resistance, Palestinian resistance against the Israeli occupation, and then the Israeli will feel that there is no security for them because of the resistance, and they try to attack more of the Palestinian resistance and Palestinian villages and towns. So it's a kind of a sequel, and the consequences of the Israeli atrocities, definitely there will be at least the Palestinian resistance to resist to the against the Israeli atrocities, which is something that we consider not only normal, but it's totally, we can understand that, because the Palestinian cannot tolerate and stay calm when the Israeli are grabbing the land and killing the people, arresting the people, and also attacking all these areas, villages and towns. So resistance started to grow up more, particularly in Jenin, and later on will be also in the rest of the cities to resist the Israeli occupation.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Saad Nimr, Professor of Political Science from the Brightside University of Ramallah. Also, our correspondent Mona Kendall, keeping a close watch on the developments there. Thanks to both of you for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review. And thanks to all of you for following us. Yemeni army holds a parade in the capital Sana'a, showcasing new weapons and military equipment in a public display of force against the aggressors. The weapons include rockets, armored vehicles, and drones, among others. Addressing the military personnel, a leader of the Ansarullah movement said the army's power will be used as long as the Saudi and Western attempts to dominate Yemen continue. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said that the weapons will be used to liberate every inch of Yemeni land under foreign occupation. Saudi Arabia began a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015. Tens of thousands of people have been killed and many others displaced. And millions of pilgrims from across the world are converging on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala for the annual commemoration of Arba'in. The pilgrims, many of them from Iran, are making the journey towards Karbala on foot. The city houses the shrine of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. This year, the pilgrimage, which is one of the largest religious congregations in the world, reaches its peak on the 17th of September. Arba'in marks 40 days after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein. On that day, the Imam and dozens of his companions were martyred during the Battle of Karbala nearly 14 centuries ago. And the Iranian army has hosted an international mountain climbing event. The sport event engaged participant troops in a five-day climb up to the top of Iran's Mount Damavand. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Recent reports in scientific journals have shown that breathing polluted air in the European continent has reduced people's lives. Also, these reports have announced the premature death of about 1.3 million people in Europe. That is about 25% of the annual death of this continent is due to air pollution and cancer. Air pollution causes the increase of underlying diseases and cardiovascular problems, and based on new research conducted, air pollution is directly related to lung and also to other cancers. Pollution is reportedly linked to 10% of cancer cases in Europe. The main cause of air pollution in big cities is industry and factories, which play a big role in polluting the air by producing methane, carbon dioxide, fuel oil, and other polluting gases. Smoke and toxic substances produced by cars and vehicles also play an important role in air pollution in big cities. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some of the world's media. Please stay with us. The website of the European Environment Agency writes, according to a new report, pollutants in the environment and at the workplace, as well as some natural risks, have a huge impact on our health and in some cases lead to cancer. With nearly 3 million new patients and 1.3 million deaths each year across the European Union, cancer takes a huge toll on this society. The economic costs are also enormous, estimated at around 178 billion euros in 2018 alone. According to the European Environment Agency's study, most of these environmental and occupational cancer risks can be reduced by preventing pollution and changing behaviours. Reducing exposure to these risks offers an effective and cost-effective way of reducing cancer cases and associated deaths. For the first time, the European Environment Agency investigated the links between cancer and the environment, reviewing the latest scientific evidence on air pollution, radon, ultraviolet radiation, secondhand smoke and chemicals. The report estimates that environmental and occupational risks lie behind around 10% of cancer cases in Europe. Virginijus Sinkevičius, the European Union Commissioner for the Environment, Fisheries and Oceans, says, the European Environment Agency report highlights that too many cancer cases have an underlying environmental cause. Stella Kyriakides, the EU Commissioner for Health and Food Safety, says, every year in Europe, an estimated over a quarter of a million lives are lost to environmental-related cancer. The findings of the European Environment Agency show very clearly how the health of our planet and the health of our citizens are closely interlinked. We need to work with nature, not against it. The British daily The Guardian sheds more light on this issue. The Guardian reports, scientists have uncovered how air pollution causes lung cancer in groundbreaking research that promises to rewrite our understanding of the disease. The findings outline how fine particulates contained in car fumes awaken dormant mutations in lung cells and tip them into a cancerous state. The work helps explain why so many non-smokers develop lung cancer and is a wake-up call about the damaging impact of pollution on human health. Professor Charles Swanton of the Francis Crick Institute, who presented the findings at the European Society for Medical Oncology conference in Paris on Saturday, 10th of September, said, "The risk of lung cancer from air pollution is lower than from smoking, but we have no control over what we all breathe." He adds, Globally, more people are exposed to unsafe levels of air pollution than to toxic chemicals in cigarette smoke. And these new data link the importance of addressing climate health to improving human health. Smoking remains the biggest cause of lung cancer, but outdoor air pollution causes about 1 in 10 cases in the United Kingdom, and an estimated 6,000 people who have never smoked in their lives die of lung cancer every year. Globally, about 300,000 lung cancer deaths in 2019 were attributed to exposure to fine particulate matter, known as PM2.5, contained in air pollution. However, the biological basis for how air pollution causes cancer has remained unclear. Unlike smoking or sun exposure, which directly cause DNA mutations linked to lung and skin cancer, air pollution does not cause cancer by triggering such genetic changes. Instead, those with non-smoking lung cancer tend to carry mutations that are also seen in healthy lung tissue. Small errors that we accumulate in our DNA throughout our lives and which normally remain innocuous. Professor Swanton, who is also Cancer Research UK's chief clinician, says, "Clearly these patients are getting cancer without having mutations, so there's got to be something else going on." He adds, "Air pollution is associated with lung cancer, but people have largely ignored it because the mechanisms behind it were unclear." The Financial Times also explains more about this story. The Financial Times reports, "Two important environmental carcinogens, tobacco smoke and ultraviolet light, damage DNA and create mutations that generate tumors." But the researchers found no evidence that PM2.5 particles directly mutate DNA, which prompted them to look for a different explanation. They found that the particles caused inflammation, which activated pre-existing mutations in genes that drive the development of many lung cancers. Professor Charles Swanton says, "The mechanism we've identified could ultimately help us find better ways to prevent and treat lung cancer in never smokers." He adds, "The next step is to discover why some lung cells with mutations become cancerous when exposed to pollutants, while others don't." Amelia Lim, another member of the Francis Crick Institute's research team, says the findings may be applicable to other cancers associated with air pollution, including mesothelioma and tumours of the throat and mouth. Amelia Lim adds, 99% of the world's population lives in areas which exceed annual World Health Organization's limits for PM2.5 particles, underlining the public health challenges posed by air pollution across the globe. Exposure to secondhand smoke may increase the overall risk for all cancers by up to 16% in people who have themselves never been smokers. Around 31% of Europeans are exposed to secondhand tobacco smoke, either at home or at work, during leisure, or in educational institutions or in public settings. Hans Bruininks, the European Environment Agency's executive director, says, "We see the impact of pollution in our environment has on health and quality of life of European citizens, and that is why preventing pollution is so crucial to our well-being. Cutting pollution through the European Union Zero Pollution Action Plan and the Chemical Strategy for Sustainability, as well as strong implementation of other existing European Union policies, would go a long way to reduce cancer cases and deaths from cancer. This would be an effective investment in our citizens' well-being."
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program, The Muslim Lady. This is your host, Zainab, and I have with me Siddiqa. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
A very warm welcome, Siddiqa.
Thank you very much.
Dear listeners, Siddiqa is a student of jurisprudence in the Hausa Ilmi of Qom, and she's also a researcher. She researches a lot on the issues related to women. All right, Siddiqa, in our previous sessions, we have been talking about abortion and how Islam looks at it in general and case by case. Now, I want to ask from you, what about the secular world? What does the secular world say about abortion?
So today in the secular world, there's either an absolute right to abortion or an absolute criminality of abortion, right? So in America, we saw when the Roe versus Wade case was overturned, it absolutely criminalized abortion to an extent that even if a woman is suffering through ectopic pregnancy, she would not be allowed to take the necessary medication to get rid of the fetus, which is not a viable pregnancy anyways, because one, it cannot develop in the tubes of the mother, that's one, and two, it would cause harm to the mother, especially if it were to continue growing, and it would lead to the bursting of the tubes, and it could lead to very
harmful consequences.
Harmful consequences for the mother, and especially her uterus, and everything would be affected.
Okay.
But that is like, that's an absolute criminality of abortion. And then there's an absolute legalization of abortion. You don't want the pregnancy, but you know, bismillah, go take it out. Those are two absolute spectrums in the secular world from what I have read. First, before we come to Islam's view, those who support absolute abortion, the right to abortion, they say if we do not legalize abortion, then women will go for unsafe abortions.
Okay.
That is not very logical, because I don't want women to go for unsafe abortions, I legalize abortions. When Islam doesn't look at it like that. In the secular world, only the woman, only the mother is being seen as an entity, and the child is given absolutely little to no
rights. It does not have an identity.
Yes, in that part of the world. Because in the secular world, the soul is not seen as anything of importance. They do not consider the soul to be important. Funnily enough, they consider the heartbeat to be important, right?
Okay.
Or they look at the heartbeat of the child. If I were to say, am I living? They would say, yes, your heart is beating, you're living. But if we are supposed to use the same argument for a fetus, the fetus heartbeat develops at 6 weeks anyways. So why don't we give that child the same right? The heart is beating, it's a living being now. Why is that child not being given its own identity, given they already has a heartbeat? And the heartbeat is the criteria by which a being is recognized in the secular world.
Okay.
Right? So again, there's this sort of contrasting views that are coming about when we look at abortion through that side of the world.
All right.
Now, when it comes to Islam, again, like we mentioned a few times, Islam does not give an absolute right to abortion and does not absolutely criminalize abortion, because there could be cases where it becomes necessary to save the life of the mother.
Okay. So you're trying to say that in Islam, we don't have absolute right to abortion. We don't have even absolute right to criminalize it. But in secular world, at some part of the world, we do have some rights which give absolute right, and we have some parts of the world which absolutely criminalize this.
Yes.
We'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. This is the Muslim lady, and we're talking about abortion. We're looking at abortion in the secular point of view, in the Islamic point of view, where do we have absolute right, where it's absolutely criminalized, and we're comparing all that with Islamic spectrum. Yes, Siddiq.
Now, Islam's view, again, on abortion, like we've mentioned previously, is that when there's a safe, viable pregnancy with no harm, then there would be no right to abortion over here. And if the parents chose to go for abortion, they would have to pay blood money. So let's say the mother went for the abortion, then she has to pay blood money to the inheritors of the child, who would be the father in this case. And you also have to seek forgiveness because you have taken something that is not yours as such. Just because you're bringing this child into this world,
Does not mean it belongs to you. It's an amana.
It's a trust. It's a trust from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the child is a being that Allah has created. Yes, there was a relationship which caused the being, but Islam does not recognize the parents as the total cause of the child. They're known as illat naqisah, which is sort of a partial cause only.
Okay.
Right? So they're not the complete and the absolute cause of a child, and the other causes as well. So that's there. In the secular world, when it comes to some parts of the world, like, for example, post Roe versus Wade overturning of that court case, of that ruling, it has criminalized abortion across the board. If a woman were suffering from an ectopic pregnancy, she would not be allowed to take the necessary medication. But Islam says the opposite. This is not a viable pregnancy. It does not have the ability to become a fully grown human being, and it would also cause harm to the mother, therefore abortion would be allowed. Abortion over here, not in its sense, it would just mean taking the medication to remove the fetus because it's not viable anymore.
When we saw these different kinds of protests happening across the United States, the court rulings and the people coming out to the streets, especially women, from different parts, supporting those women as well, holding the placards. He was trying to say that court ruling says something and these protesters say something and Islam says something. I would want you to compare all the three. What the court ruling said, what the protesters say, and what Islam says.
So when the court ruling Roe versus Wade was overturned, it said that women do not have a right to abortion anymore. That means they're not allowed In any case. They're not even allowed to take medication to let go of a non-viable pregnancy. Right?
Which is even harmful,
like ectopic pregnancies. They would not be given access to the correct medication.
Well, in this case, Islam says exactly the opposite.
Islam says opposite. You're allowed to take the medication because it is a non-viable pregnancy which would cause harm to the mother and could actually end up in her death. Because if the fetus were to continue growing in the tubes, endanger the tubes, and as a consequence, the mother would be harmed. Either her uterus would see harm, or she herself would see infections, which would be quite drastically bad for her.
I remember a friend of mine who was calling me and asking me continuously to pray for me, who was pregnant, and then I didn't understand why she's so much asking me to pray. And then I realized that she was suffering with a pregnancy which was extremely harmful for her. And since she waited, she had this hope, everything will be fine. The poison had spread throughout her body and even her life was in danger if she did not go for abortion. So we have different rules in different cases. We'll talk more on that after a short break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
I'm with Sadiqa and we're talking on abortion. Sadiqa.
So the protesters who are protesting against these court rulings are asking for an absolute right to abortion. And they say, they come with the idea that it is my body, therefore my choice. And I'd like to do what I want with my body.
Doesn't matter whether it's harmful, it's not harmful.
Exactly.
In any case.
The absolute right to abortion over here is what they are asking for. On the basis that because it's my body, I should have a right to what to do with my body. Now, while we do have a right over our bodies, we do not have the right to regulate someone else's life. Because Islam sees that child as being an independent identity, and it is only dependent on the mother for the first 9 months. After that, it comes into this world, then it's given a whole set of different rules. But only that it's a period of 9 months where it is dependent on the mother. And that even right now, with how technology is advancing, we are actually able to conclude that the child is dependent on the mother while it is in the womb. It is given an independent identity as such. The my body, my choice when it comes to another being, and it is not seen as a correct argument in Islam's view. Because that pregnancy was a result of two consensual adults' opinions. Again, over here we are excluding issues of rape and other issues that where there is no
harm
consent.
Harm your body or harm the child.
We're not talking about issues without consent. We're talking about issues with consent in this part of the episode. So where there are two adults who have been consensual in their relationship, the my body, my choice goes out the window because now there's a different entity, there's a different being whose rights have to be protected. And if we do not protect the rights of others, there would be transgression of rights. Islam would give that child the right to live and the right to come into this world without its progress being hindered by choices that are not in its hand. Then we go into the other arguments that these protesters do come about with is single mothers, right?
Okay.
Which is a very difficult subject. We do know that a lot of women do end up single mothers. Now, single mothers, even though the life is hard, it is not generally, I'll use the term generally, generally it does not classify as excessive hardship.
Okay.
Right? Given that
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the absolute sustainer.
Allah is the absolute sustainer. The sustaining of the child is on the father. Now, regardless of whether people follow through these rules or not, I will first look at the rules itself.
Okay.
Right? Because Islam has a set of rules. Then the people who do not follow anything.
Okay.
Right? So even though single mother's life is hard, it might not classify as extreme hardship. Now, in those cases where it comes extreme hardship, those are other cases that need to be looked at on a case-by-case basis, and I'm not here for that. But the father is the one who's supposed to be provided, and a lot of courts around the world, if there is a relationship and a child is born, then the father is forced. Even today, there are many women do go to court to force the fathers to pay for child support. So again, those services are present, which kind of reduces that permissibility of aborting the child only on the basis that I personally cannot provide for the child.
I cannot afford because I'm a single mother.
Yes.
Well, there are different cases and there are different rulings. Secular world says different things. Islam has a different spectrum. And we compared all those. We even looked at the views what the protesters said. Thank you so much, Sadiqa, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah.
Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
By shying away from graphic images of death, news organizations sanitize the violence of Israeli regime aggression against Palestinians. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written jointly by Elise Swain and Alice Sperry, writers. This article is published under the heading, Americans Rarely See the True Face of Israeli Regime's Bombing of Gaza. Here's the story. When a ceasefire ended a three-day Israeli regime offensive in the Gaza Strip, over 350 Palestinians were wounded and 46 were dead, including 16 children, according to Palestinian officials. Media coverage in the U.S. was mainly led by photographs of smoke-filled skies or Gazans walking amid piles of rubble. While the photos were accurate and recent, the safety of selecting these images rather than graphic ones effectively portrayed a reality for American audiences far removed from what had truly unfolded on the ground. To look at the totality of images that are made during a news event is an experience most Americans, with the exception of photo editors in newsrooms, rarely experience. As the Palestinian death toll climbed over the weekend, images from photojournalists based in Gaza poured into massive databases like Getty Images and AP Images. A quick search for Gaza on Getty Images, for example, returns hundreds of recent photographs, a near-endless grid of brutality from the last week. In many images, children killed by Israeli regime bombs are displayed prominently. These images show funerals, the faces of the deceased uncovered, their bodies held aloft and marched through the streets. In some photographs, mourners are seen taking their own images of the bodies on their cell phones, proof of what horrors have occurred. These graphic images are arrayed on photo databases next to the non-graphic images that are almost always selected for publication by U.S. news organizations. Rockets flying through the sky at night, quiet moments of children surveying the damage done to their homes, and black smoke rising over the horizon. In Gaza, photojournalists routinely photograph within hospitals and morgues. This access to urgent care facilities, rare in the United States, provides an opportunity for journalists to directly document the wounded and dead. On Getty Images, images of children's bodies wrapped in white fabric piling up at the morgue are abundant and uncensored. While shocking and deeply upsetting, they do show very clearly what bombing dense residential areas produces. I can still see the grieving people weeping after their homes were destroyed, Palestinian photojournalist Hossam Salem told The Intercept, adding, I can't handle it anymore. Even after these 3 days of Israeli regime attacks are over, I have become more drained than before. In Gaza, there are no stories that can give us life. All we can say is how death has taken our lives and the lives of those around us. In general, the majority of coverage by international and American media is weak and often does not show scenes where innocent women and children were killed. Soleiman Haji, a Palestinian visual journalist working in Gaza, told The Intercept, in the case of one of the 16 children killed, 5-year-old Ala Qadoum, one report in the New York Times included a photograph made after her death. This was the exception, though the photo was not featured prominently. It was placed near the end of the article. Other outlets from the Washington Post to NBC News did not publish the image, even as they mentioned the girl's killing. What we are left with is, in essence, a sanitized and avoidant understanding of world events as newsrooms uniformly opt for images that do not include any graphic content. Social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook have enforced this shift away from publishing depictions of violence by implementing sensitive media policies that discourage newsrooms from prominently displaying images of atrocities lest they lose page views. There is no consensus on how to deal with images of intense violence. Individual newsrooms make decisions on a case-by-case basis, often after sorting through troves of images filed to major distribution platforms where none of the images are blurred or censored. On Getty Images, only within the caption information is there sometimes an editor's notes warning the viewer about what they're already looking at. Image depicts death. Most media outlets, including this one, issue an editor's note or content warning before surprising viewers with depictions of graphic violence. It is not just Palestinian bodies that are erased from mass media accounts of massacres. School shootings in America and the scenes that have become visually defined by makeshift memorials and candlelit visuals rather than graphic images. And the same is true for the bloodshed that occurs overseas, but there are exceptions. The problem with the representation of Palestinian life and death goes well beyond the images selected to tell the story. Palestinians and many foreign observers have long condemned the international media for sanitizing the Zionist regime's crimes and deferring to the Israeli regime's narrative. In a letter signed by more than 500 journalists following yet another Israeli regime bombing campaign on Gaza last year, the authors, including several Intercept reporters, argued that coverage of the Israeli regime and Palestine regularly amounts to journalistic malpractice. The asymmetry in context does not just extend to the language we use. Stories tend to disproportionately amplify Israeli regime narratives while suppressing Palestinian ones, the group wrote. obfuscating Israeli regime's oppression of Palestinians fails this industry's own objectivity standards. Ahmad Abu Artma, a Palestinian writer and human rights activist who in 2018 was one of the organizers of the Great March of Return, a peaceful protest movement by the fence separating the Zionist regime from Gaza, told Intercept that the Israeli regime operated on the assumption that they would have an ally in most of the international media. He said, "This is complicity. We don't want anything more than for people to know the facts. We don't have a complicated narrative. Our demand is only that people watch the facts, watch the reality, see the footage of what's happening." Across newsrooms, the safe choices of showing an abstracted violence, including calm moments of smoke and rubble, over overt violence, including death, injury, or mourning, fall in line with the framework of the coverage itself, which in Gaza's case regularly downplays the impact of civilians in favor of a narrative about Palestinian militancy, even as the same kind of militancy is depicted as resistance in Ukraine. Mohammad Mohawesh, an independent Palestinian journalist and researcher based in Gaza, argued in an interview with The Intercept that coverage of the latest Gaza assault, which Israeli regime officials admitted was preemptive, focused almost exclusively on the Zionist regime's ostensible justification for attack rather than its impact. And even though the majority of victims were not engaged in acts of resistance, the portrayal of Palestinian resistance, he added, stands in a stark contrast with that of the Ukrainian people. For the past month, newspapers and websites and social media have been filled with the stories of Ukrainian resistance and heroism, stories about soldiers blowing up bridges to delay the approach of Russian tanks and sacrificing themselves in the process. We have seen civilians attacking armed vehicles with whatever they have and common people receiving weapons training and digging trenches, Mohawesh said, adding, "And yet, if any of these stories took place in Palestine rather than Ukraine, they would of course not be perceived as acts of heroism and resistance. They would only be classified and condemned as terror." Mohawesh stressed the comparison was not intended to diminish the resistance of the Ukrainian people, but to uphold the right to resist the occupation and military intervention of any land by any nation.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.